Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. Nope. Yeah, fucking hell. 2 weeks in a row I did it. God damn it. You know what? We're keeping this in the show. Welcome to Homer and Applesauce. What's this fucking show called? Today or Love Tomorrow, the World Series. God damn. It's late. My brain is broken and the Mets keep killing me. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, we are in a stretch right now of just truly horrific baseball. The Mets have lost five straight series. They have not won two games in a row since the series in San Francisco. They have not had any real glimmers of hope in there that have lasted more than a game or so. And it just seems like every day something new goes wrong for the team. We start with a vibe check every week. My vibe check is not just in the basement, but in like the storm cellar under the basement. what are you feeling right now?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I think as somebody who tries to keep an optimistic outlook on this team, they're making it really hard to make that case. They're 4-13 in their last 17. And one of the things I like to do in general, but especially when things are going really well or really poorly, is just pull up the schedule and results page on Baseball Reference. And look, I don't know, there's just something about that old-fashioned, simple spreadsheet kind of format to it. So many L's in that column right now over the last few weeks. And it's kind of incredible. As bad as they've been, they're 18-20. Right?
Yeah, they're only two games under 500. That blew my mind today.
Yeah, it feels much worse than that. They need to start doing things that are good on a consistent basis. They don't have to win 10 games in a row, but they need to win 7 out of 10. A stretch like that, which they are capable of, I think.
Maybe.
But yeah, I guess... I hope they are. And look, this is not the Reds, Rockies, Tigers, Nationals are not the Braves. This was supposed to be an easy stretch of the schedule. And you can't expect to sweep every team that's clearly worse than you going into each of those series. But you should definitely expect not to lose every one of them. So that's not great. I don't know where we can get into a little bit of like the ideas of how they might be able to turn it around. But it's pretty bad. I guess two silver linings. The bar has been lowered significantly by Major League Baseball for making the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And obviously coming off last year, we wanted them to win the division. But I don't necessarily think that by, obviously advancing around by not having to play is a good thing. But whether or not that by and the break are beneficial to a team and their chances to win that second round, I think it'll take some time to determine that. Last year would be the ultimate small sample size. Right. But the bar is pretty low to get in. And we've seen, I don't want to rationalize terrible baseball with, oh, well, it's okay. Other teams have done this recently, and then they get in, and then they go on to either make or win the World Series.
I mean, look at the Cardinals in 06. Right, they were barely a playoff team. They beat the Mets and won the World Series.
Yeah. So, I think everybody right now, as much as I like to sort of what's the right word, poke a little fun at the negativity that often surrounds this team, I think right now everybody has the absolute right to be negative.
Sure.
But it is not over yet. There are only two teams in the National League that are significantly over 500, and it's the Braves and the Dodgers. The Pirates Cinderella story seems to be you know, coming up on midnight already in May.
Very nice continuation of metaphor there, by the way.
Thank you.
Cinderella story and midnight. That's impressive.
Thank you. but you look around, the Padres have been, I think, slightly better than the Mets. I think right now they lost today too, which would make them a half game better than the Mets. Again, I don't want to sit and make excuses. It's just, it's a long season. There's a lot of games left, and it's not like the Mets are in the American League East where,
right.
You know, I don't know if this is still true right now, but for most of this season so far, that entire division has been over 500. And yeah, it is still true. The Yankees are three games over 500. They're in last place.
Yeah, I mean, that also happens when you have a team off to an historically amazing start.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, and divisional play is reduced in this new schedule and all that. But yeah, the Mets are not stuck in a division where every team has a winning record. Every team has a positive run differential. And as you said, one of them is just they're world beaters right now. And let's just hope things go well in Washington, because people are going to assume they're going to get swept by the Rays no matter what happens over the next 4 days. But it would be nice if the Mets could, I don't know, get to 500 at least before that series against Tampa starts.
That'd be nice, yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, some people in the comments at AmazingAvenue.com for my game recap today were calling me a crybaby. Because I was down on the team. And I think that I have a relatively even disposition with all things Mets. Compared to some of our friends who I will not name, I think I am pretty even keel. But I said today, like, you know, it's starting to look like this isn't a slump. Like, this is maybe the actual state of the team right now. Now, I did not say this is 100% the certainty. I just said it's starting to feel like more than just a slump. But some people were also quick to point out in the comments today that I believe at this point in the season, we being the Mets, are exactly sort of where the Braves were last season. And then they played amazing baseball for the rest of the year and wound up taking over first place.
Right. And I think that is a valuable lesson. The Mets had, what, a 10-game lead in the division for most of May, June, and July last year?
Something like that, yeah.
So,
but also, like, while it is useful information, the Braves also went on like a never before seen run for most of the summer, and really can't expect a team to do that 2 years in a row.
Yeah,
any team, you know, I'm not saying one. You can't expect two teams in the same division to have similar runs 2 years in a row. But again, I think at this point, if the Mets make it in as one of the wild card teams, that's we have to be okay with that. But it is very early, and I am not writing off the Mets. I'm not. But I think that we're getting to a point in the season where we can't just be relying on small sample size excuses or talking about how, you know, the Mets have had a historically bad run of XYZ. Because honestly, they haven't. They've played shitty teams. And they've played really poorly against said shitty teams. And yes, there was mediocre starting pitching in that time. And yes, there are some guys who are still playing who should be on the IL. And we'll get to that in a second. And yes, I almost said Terry Collins. Goodness gracious. Buck Showalter has been, you know, was playing Escobar probably a little bit longer than he should have. And was certainly starting Nito more than he probably should have. And probably overusing certain bullpen arms. Like, all that is true. But nothing happened that was so unusual that you can chalk up the season's problems to the novelty of whatever the situation is. We're at a point now where they're just playing like garbage. And they're playing like garbage on a couple different levels. You know, they're not hitting right now at all. You know, again, a Tuesday's game, they came back too late, but they came back. They showed some spunk. Wednesday's game, they only scored two runs, but they had Verlander looking like vintage Verlander. And so they didn't need to score more than two runs. And then today's game, they just looked like a team that could not hit themselves out of a paper bag. And, you know, Senga went five today. And aside from a bad first inning, which was aided by a couple of things that were out of his control, he didn't look terrible. You know, Jerry Blevins, who, by the way, let's just give it up for Jerry Blevins, doing a really good job as a color man this week. I think we're all pretty big Jerry fans around these parts. But yeah, he did a really nice job this week. And he kept saying, like, I know this is a results-based game, but in terms of process, he liked today's start from Senga for a couple of reasons. And I love that perspective being brought to the broadcast booth. But, you know, but he's right. At a certain point, it is about the results, and the results just weren't there today. You know, we have Max Scherzer, who said he's, quote, fighting like hell to not go on the IL, and then missed the start for the thing he wasn't even talking about when he said that, for a different injury. And, you know, it just seems like the bad luck argument to me is running out, because at a certain point, it's not luck, it's just the reality. And I'm not writing the team off yet, but I think it is absolutely within your rights as a fan at this point to wonder sort of what the trajectory for the team for the rest of the season is. I think we've seen enough of it now that at least asking the questions feels valid to me.
Yeah, no, totally. The point on Blevins I actually wanted to touch on a little bit. I've made this comparison a couple times in seeing some of the work he's done this year, but for Rangers fans who watch their broadcasts on MSG, Jerry Blevins is to me, very similar to Steve Valiquette, where you have a sharp former player who's a little bit younger. So I'm not saying that Ron and Keith aren't sharp. They are. They really know the game in and out. But somebody who's played a little bit more recently, maybe has been teammates with some, in the case of Valiquette, that probably isn't really the reality anymore. But when he started, it was similar to Blevins. You know, he was providing analysis on some guys he played with, some guys he played against, and then other guys who were newer to the league. But they have this very similar ability to use their experience as a former player. And both like smaller roles, you know, backup goalie, relief pitcher. I feel like those are similar jobs, right?
Yeah.
But I just love that ability to speak to it as somebody with the experience and someone who can understand the analytics. In the case of Blevins, what I love is it's not even like mentioning stats that are on Fangraphs or Baseball Prospectus or anything, but it's talking about the game in a way that's in line with the way that it's been written about, you know, over the last 10 to 20 years by the, I feel like you don't even hear it called this anymore, but like the sabermetric community, right? Like,
right. He made a point during today's broadcast when Canna was up. I think it was Canna's first or second at bat of the game. And he basically lined out to the third baseman with a really hard hit ball, but it lined out. And he said, like, you know, that's not the result you want, but he hit the ball hard. He hit it on the nose. That's good process. And there's a piece in the book of Moneyball where Scott Hatterberg talks about how when he would come up to bat and he would line out, people would say things like tough break to him, whereas he felt like, no, you should be congratulating me on the line drive I just hit. Like when I dork a ball in the center field off the end of the bat and it's not great process, you shouldn't be celebrating that. You should be celebrating when I'm doing the right thing, regardless of what happens. And so that, again, Moneyball came out 20 years ago, so it's not like this is a new concept, but you almost never hear an older broadcaster speak about it that way. They might say, oh, we hit that one on the screws, you got unlucky, but Blevins just put it in a way that, like you said, is sort of more sabermetrically friendly.
Yeah. So I hope we get to hear more of him in games, right? Not everybody, myself included, not everybody tunes in early enough to catch the pregame show or sticks around for the postgame show. You know, especially as Major League Baseball has made an effort to make games more concise and all that. it's kind of like, all right, the game's over. I'd be more inclined to watch more of the studio stuff if the Mets were winning 13 out of 17 games instead of the opposite. Yeah. But yeah, good stuff from Blevins. And I hope we get more in-game content with him, whether it's filling in when they don't have Ron or Keith, if they want a third person in that booth, or just the scenario that we saw this week. I mean, Keith was there, but you know, sort of the B team overall, and he's in there. Alternatively, you could just not have him replace Gelbs, but maybe have some segments that he does that play during a game. You know, where he's talking to a pitcher about how they do their job and their, you know, their pitch shapes and all that kind of stuff. It's just, it's been refreshing. And yeah, we have to latch onto this because what else has there been to enjoy lately? I mean, Verlander being himself and Blevins being an asset as like a pinch hitting commentator. That's what we've got right now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Verlander being himself definitely helps things a little bit. I think we could all agree that is a positive bit of this past week. I do want to talk about the other co-ace on the team, which is Max Scherzer. We mentioned that he's trying to stay off the IL. At this point, if you were in the Mets brass, would you just IL him?
Yes.
Okay. Same question, different player. If you were part of the Mets brass, would you IL Starling Marte?
Yeah, and faster than Scherzer. I mean, Scherzer is continuously not ready to pitch lately, and he's older. And probably more important, I mean, Marte being himself is also important to this team, like no doubt about that. But if you look at a playoff series and maybe a wild card series as a realistic possibility right now, despite his performance in that wild card series game last year, you need Scherzer to be available.
Yes.
So, yeah. But I still would IL Marte faster because he's been so bad since he left that one game with like the neck strain. And I think I forget if the Mets had an off day or if he sat for one day afterwards, but whatever the case, he looked great. He looked like himself for the first 2.5 weeks of the season. And then he has just been absolutely awful since then. And it's a short break. Just, you know, you put him on there, even if it isn't that injury, you know, maybe it's that injury led to some bad habits and now he can't break them, but he's not doing anybody any good. I mean, the fact that they moved him down in the batting order seems like a minor miracle. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he's toast at 34. I think he hurt himself and either he's still hurt or, you know, like I just said, he got into a bad place with how he's playing. And since he returned to the lineup a couple days after he got hurt, he's got a 34 weighted runs created plus. Like, you know, 177, 253, 190. That's not going to do it. And what's frustrating is about halfway through this stretch, we made this point. I wrote about it on Amazing Avenue. We're not in the room every day. We don't know, but you can look at it and just see. I mean, he's had one extra base hit in his last 88 plate appearances. And, you know, not that he's like a 40 home run guy, but this is somebody who can hit the ball hard and is fast enough to turn a ball in the gap into a double pretty easily. You know, a ball over an outfielder's head or down the line into a triple. You know, you can build up a nice slugging percentage without hitting tons of home runs. And we know he's capable of that. And last year, over the course of the whole season, he had a 176 isolated slugging, and right now he has a .06.
Ooh.
Which, like, it's just not him.
No, it's not.
So, yeah. Yeah, he would have been on the IL at least a week ago if it were up to me. And I just don't understand.
What about a recent addition to the IL is Tomas Nito, who was put on with dry eye syndrome?
Yeah, that's look, if it's really something he's dealing with and somebody in his family listens to this podcast, then I'm sorry for being skeptical. But man, that sounds like bullshit.
It really does. Dry eyes is a thing for people. And I'm sure that, you know, like I have bad seasonal allergies. And this year I'm knocking on some wood. It hasn't been so bad. But there are years when my eyes will itch like 24 hours a day. And it's terrible. And so if he's going through something like that, I get it. It sucks. But it just seems like they needed to get him some time off because he was hitting like half his weight this season so far and just really looking bad on both sides of the ball. You know, if you have him to be your defensive specialist, he needs to be good on defense, and he hasn't been very good behind the dish this season yet. And so I get wanted to give him a break, but you couldn't come up with, I don't know, back strain, something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no. It's got to be a weird thing to be a part-time catcher. If Narvaez ever comes back, like Omar Narvaez being a Met seems like something that didn't happen.
Correct.
But if he comes back anytime soon, Alvarez isn't going anywhere. And, you know, Nito got paid when the Mets signed him to cover his – it's just his last 2 years of arbitration. But it's still like $4.5 million, something like that in total. Right. You know, that's a significant accomplishment. I mean, making it to the big leagues at all is one, and then breaking through the severely underpaid phase of your major league career is another one. And I'm not saying his career is over, but his time with the Mets could come to an end if Narvaez is back and Alvarez is just doing what he's doing now. There's really not a spot for Nito on the roster.
Right.
So, I mean, it's got to mess with your head, and it's got to put a ton of pressure on when now you're back to being a backup. And in those, you know, two or three games out of every 10 that you get to play, you're not performing. You know, so if it really is an eye issue, then I genuinely apologize for being skeptical of it. But if it's more of a you know, psychological one that, like, hey, I hope the break works. Like, we have nothing against Tomas Nito. He's been nothing other than a solid player who's, I think, far exceeded any expectations that were placed on him when he was first called up to the big leagues.
Correct. I also wish that there was a mechanism in baseball for people to be given a break without having to lie about these things.
Right.
You know, like we've recently seen a number of players, including, you know, former Met Trevor May, go on the IL for anxiety issues or mental health issues in general. And that's great. But there should be something along those lines of just like, dude needs a break.
right.
Because I think that it's healthier to think about things in that way than to force people to make shit up otherwise.
Right. Or to do that or explicitly come out and say that that's what they have going on.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah. Hey, credit to Trevor May for talking about it. Bill Pulsifer came on during a broadcast and talked about how much it affected him in his career, to the point that even when he threw out a first pitch at Citi Field the other day, like, he felt that come back.
Yeah.
Being out there as just a guest who, you know, Mets fans obviously know who he is, but, you know, it's not Tom Seaver throwing a pitch to Mike Piazza, right? Like,
Right.
And yet that feeling still came back. And it's, you know, I think it's good in multiple contexts for people to actually talk about that. You know, there's sports itself, which can be very unforgiving. And then also just society in general, I think, has such a long way to go. And people just saying like, yep, that's what's going on. So, you know, we certainly can't say that we know what exactly is going on with Tomas Nieto. But whatever it is, I hope the stint on the IL, you know, helps him out.
Absolutely. Yes. Without a question. We should somewhat shift our conversation here. And there's two players in the minors. We've talked about them before. Mark Vientos and Ronnie Mauricio, who are, you know, looking quite good in AAA right now. Mauricio is undergoing a bit more of a transition in his career. He's learning to play second base, might learn to play the outfield a little bit. So I think the conversation is a little bit different around Mauricio. But Mark Vientos is hitting the shit out of the ball right now in AAA. I mean, just for context, he is batting .353 with a .444 on base percentage and a .714 slugging percentage.
Yeah.
You know, in 33 games, he has 11 home runs. He has had 42 hits. He's scored 22 runs. You know, he has 85 total bases in the first 33 games of the season. He is just hitting the cover off the ball. And so Chris and I are each going to make a case for one of these guys to come up. And we're going to start with Ronnie Mauricio. How would you get Mauricio in this lineup?
So I think the move for either of these guys to come up is Marte to the injured list, right? So that I think we'd be starting on the same path there, since
right.
we and seemingly everybody else agree that that should happen. So in that case, yes, Mauricio is inexperienced, relatively speaking, at second base, hasn't been the best defender in the minor leagues at short. So, you know, it'd be fair to maybe have some concerns about what that looks like if he gets called up and splits his time, let's say, between second base and DH. But if Marte's on the injured list, Jeff McNeil's a capable outfielder. You know, he can get out there in the corner and pretty much just be your everyday right fielder while you see what Mauricio can do at second base. Later in games, you can bring Guillorme in for defensive reasons if Mauricio is a little bit concerning there and you have a lead. The Mets having a lead just sounds so like foreign right now, but
how novel.
But you could play it that way. You know, you call up an infielder, it's definitely going to put a dent in Guillorme's playing time. But you have Mauricio and McNeil in the lineup pretty much every day. You're not overexposing anybody in left field where Tommy Pham and Mark Canna can split time. And also, you can do this for like, I don't know, 6-10 games, something like that, and just see how it goes. And if it's not like a major success, that's fine. But I think that opportunity is there. And if you really felt like you wanted Guillorme to start during that little experiment at second with McNeil still in the outfield, then okay, that's fine. And I guess for me, I mean, it's not a knock on Vientos. He's doing everything he can. And Mauricio's line is almost as good. Not, the slugging is not almost 700, but it's almost 600. and you know, there's just something there that I think I know Vientos had gotten some prospect hype, at least in like the Mets organizational rankings, which is something that obviously our friends who have done all that work for Amazing Avenue over the years have touched on. But Mauricio had that consensus top 100, consensus top 50 prospect in baseball hype not right. that long ago. And I know pretty much everyone who gave him that hype gave up on him as a significant prospect after last season. But there's just something about that. Like forecasting what prospects are going to do is a very difficult thing. But I don't know, even for you and I who don't spend the majority of our time, our baseball time doing that, I understand when a guy jumps off the page.
Yes, you know, we always cite Andrés Giménez.
Right.
Right. As a guy we saw in spring training where both of us just felt like, holy shit, that's a guy.
Right. So, you know, that kind of a thing. And like, I haven't seen, you know, I saw Mauricio play in Binghamton a little bit last year. I didn't get that feeling from those games. I haven't really, I mean, COVID messed up so much of the routine of getting down to spring training and seeing players in that environment. So I can't say that he's done that for me, but he did that for a lot of people because you don't get that kind of prospect pedigree, so to speak, without having that effect on people who are watching you play. So I know that went away, but there's just something about that, you know, that track record as a prospect. And and what he's doing in Syracuse right now, that he'd be my guy. I know that might not be the majority decision right now, although I think a lot of people would call it both, but
sure.
But yeah, I'd see that. So what about you? I know on the broadcast today, they talked about Buck Showalter not wanting to call up somebody to just be a DH.
Right.
So where does Vientos fit in your prospect experiment here?
So to me, Vientos, well, let me say this first of all. I'm rooting for both of these guys for a couple of reasons. I'm rooting for them because I love it when a Mets prospect goes relatively unheralded and then lights the world on fire. That's just a fun thing. So both these guys have prospect value, but neither of them were considered to be, you know, just the cream of the crop. And if they emerge as that, awesome. Great. Let's pour one out for those guys. That's very fun. But let's talk about the way you get Vientos into this lineup. First of all, I think that, you know, I had forgotten until recently that Vientos had played a little bit of left field in the minors as recently as 2021. Not a ton of it, but a little bit of left field. He played 13 games in 21 for across a couple of systems in left field. Last season, he played exclusively first base and third base, and this season first base, third base, and DH. But if he can just stand in left field and not be Dom Smith out there, I think that this gives the Mets a couple of options. If Canna continues to struggle, if Tommy Pham continues to struggle, you could start him, let's call it, once a week in left field. I also think you could DH him at least once a week. I think you can start him at first base and let Pete DH maybe once a week. And I think you could probably do the same thing for Beatty, or if not DH Beatty, just give Beatty a day off because he is still young and you don't want to overwhelm him. And so I think that if you can get him in four different positions once a week with maybe DHing twice a week, I think if he can play four or five games a week at the major league level, you have to see if this is for real or not. It just seems to me like there's a window here where you can mess around with him in different positions. But if he plays the majority of this season at first or third in AAA and emerges as a really solid talent there, they're not going to take that chance of playing him all over, you know, a year down the road. And so I think if the goal is to trade Vientos, you don't call him up. You let him have these gaudy numbers at AAA. You establish him as a star at a position there, and then you trade him for his maximum value. If you think he's moved more value to the Mets as a role player for this season, then I think you have to bring him up soon and try him in those different places. And look, do I think Mark Vientos, left fielder, is the best move for him? Probably not, but it's the move for him that gets him playing every day next year. You know, Canada under contract next year, Pham's under contract for next year. Maybe that's the way you get him in the lineup. I don't know. But
he
might
not be Todd Hundley or Lucas Duda out there. Sorry to interrupt.
No. Yeah, I
had to reference the two worst experiments.
You'd put Dom Smith worse than Todd Hundley or Lucas Duda? You mean you wouldn't put Dom Smith as worse than them?
No, because I think he actually improved.
Fair enough.
Todd Hundley was so bad, like, they stopped.
That's true, yeah. And there wasn't a DH when those guys were playing either.
Right.
And maybe his bat is so electric, you just figure, fuck it, he's our DH. But do you agree that the time for experimentation is now with him?
Yeah. Even if I would slightly prefer, if they only called up one, that it would be Mauricio. I think one of them's got to come up for this national series. I didn't come out of all this saying, oh man, they have to fire Buck Showalter or Jeremy Hefner or whatever, but they got to do something, like some change. And I think, either one would be totally justifiable based on what those guys are doing, just like it was with Brett Beatty.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad to say that, right? Like you don't want people to have to have their jobs in the line. You don't want to put players in positions where maybe they're not going to be super comfortable. Because it's still early May. But that said, like, I mean, I'm with you. Something has to happen here. And I don't... Aside from bringing up one of those guys, is there anything else you could do that you would feel confident about?
No. I don't know if there's... I don't know if there's any realistic trades out there or anything like that. I'm neither an ardent supporter nor a hater of Buck Showalter, but I don't think relieving him of his duties is necessarily going to accomplish anything at this juncture. And I think, given how much they sort of invested in him as their manager, not just money, but the culture of the team and all that sort of thing. And it would be kind of weird to fire him a season and a third in when he still has far more wins than losses.
Right.
I think you can do the call up with either of these guys and not put them in a position where they feel like they have to be the savior. They can hit eighth or ninth. Alvarez can move up a bit. He's certainly gotten adjusted with his bat. That's all I've got for now. You, any other?
No, I think that's about it.
Yeah.
I wish I had a more creative solution to this.
Yeah.
But it just seems like that's the way to go.
Anything beyond that would be dipping into lower levels of the minors and just bringing a guy straight up, a pitcher straight up from there, and seeing what he can give you at the major league level. But that has not really been their style. And just because the Mets aren't likely to do something doesn't mean it's the right decision. But
right,
yeah.
I mean, I also feel like just in that from that perspective, who would that even be?
Like Mike Vassell and Binghamton, you know, he had that one good spring training start. That would maybe be the guy. And that just, I don't know. Mauricio and Vientos feel like you're not putting them in a spot to do something beyond, like they're conquering AAA right now.
Right.
So the only thing you can do from there is take the step up and see what you look like at the major league level. But, a pitcher in AA coming in and into a rotation and pitching staff as a whole that has an awful ERA, especially lately, that feels maybe a little bit cruel.
Fair. Anything else Mets related we got to get to before we talk about some music?
No, I not often that on the show I'll say like, damn, good job by us. But I think we covered quite a bit for a pretty shitty stretch. Yeah.
I do have one thing I wanted to mention, actually, which is the Mets signed Gary Sanchez to a minor league deal.
Oh, yeah.
And I do not think that this is the move that's going to save the season for the Mets. But I think that this, like the Dominic Leone signing from last week, this is a guy who was on a minor league contract, was able to opt out, or rather, I believe Sanchez actually asked for his release and it was granted because of the deadline passing. But regardless, somebody who, you know, is not necessarily going to win the Comeback Player of the Year award, but maybe can provide some value on a cheap deal. And I don't hate this. I don't have like crazy high hopes for him as a Met. But if he can rediscover some of that bat, if he can be less of a train wreck behind the plate, I could kind of get down with this. What do you think?
Yeah, yeah. And obviously his tenure with the Yankees was so, I don't know. I don't even know if it was divisive. It felt like everybody hated him. But it was just, he was a lightning rod in his time there.
Yes.
But this is somebody who has shown the ability to hit for power in major league games in a significant way. And someone who improved his defense behind the plate. So to have that guy in Syracuse, maybe able to come up and join the team, whether it's behind the plate or just as a DH, it doesn't hurt at all. And I know the reactions to it were a little on the like LOL Mets side of things, but this is a kind of player that if you're able to land him on a risk-free deal, like why the hell not?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I hope it works out. It's funny, we all of us, talk about pitchers getting hurt. And they do, but catchers get hurt a lot too. It's not, it's a rough position, even if it's not one that sees guys have, season ending surgery all the time, you get banged up back there.
Absolutely.
So, let's say Narvaez isn't back and Sanchez has a good week or two in Syracuse and maybe you give him a few games and, see what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, right now they have Michael Perez as the backup catcher on the major league team.
Right.
And, no offense to that guy, I don't think having Sanchez there is any riskier or worse than having...
Oh, yeah, no, everything there. Sanchez did with the Twins last year was better than what Perez has done in his entire career.
Yeah.
And that was just a decent season with the Twins. It wasn't anything crazy. But...
Right, yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like both you and I have the same sort of position on this, which is that if you have a chance to make your team even incrementally better on a risk-free deal, there's no reason to not do that every single time. And if people think this is an LOL Mets move, they either don't understand what that means, or they just forget what value at the margins of your team can do for you. And I see no reason not to do this.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right. Well, now we can tip our caps to each other for a good podcast. but let's talk about music first. What is your music pick for this week?
So I'm dipping a little into the past again, but not the too distant past because I remember when this record came out, as opposed to records that came out before we were born. So Slater Kinney this is going to be a backhanded compliment to start. I don't love what they've done over the last couple of years, but over the course of their career as a band, Slater Kinney is fucking awesome.
Yep.
And they had put out several records before they released this one, The Woods. And they had already, they had their following. they had their critical acclaim, and it was all fully warranted, just awesome songs, great band. And then they just go in and make this record where everything's intentionally just super loud, to the point that there's like fuzziness and clipping that's there. I think maybe the first time everybody who was a fan heard it, they might have thought like, oh, there's something wrong with my speakers right now. But like, nope, that was on purpose. But I love that. Like, it's just, it was different, but it was still totally them at the same time. And it's just a awesome heavy rock record. You know, they still have that, their sound, you know, their vocals aren't that different, but the production and the songwriting are, Let's Call It Love is 11 minutes long. And that is like half an early Slater Kinney album in one song in terms of length, but it's awesome. And there's a few other songs that are well over 4 minutes. Just start to finish, in recommending albums, I think at least my approach, and I don't want to speak for you, but there's always plenty of stuff on an album we recommend that's good. This one just feels that little bit extra like cohesive, where from start to finish, you're on a ride with them. And some slight pun intended with Roller Coaster being named one of the names of the songs on the record. But I've loved this record. I was fortunate at the time they were breaking up, and they had put this record out most recently when they did their like farewell tour. And I was fortunate to land a ticket to their show at Webster Hall, where they didn't play the whole thing start to finish, but they played a lot of it in that set. And they filmed that set professionally, and I still have no idea like what they ever did with that, because it's sitting on a hard drive somewhere. And I would love to get to experience it again, but very happy to have seen it. And probably the one big takeaway song from this that people may have heard in another context, Pearl Jam covers it, Modern Girl, is right in the middle of the record. And it's just, it's probably a song, I referenced it with Ben Harper last week, where the artist may have gotten a little sick of playing it because it was just so catchy and so much attention had been paid to it. I don't know if Slater Kinney felt that way about Modern Girl, because they never really like stopped playing it or anything. But when Pearl Jam's out there like covering your song on a semi-regular basis, that song has made it.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah. If you've never listened to Slater Kinney at all, then this may not be the most representative thing of their entire catalog. But it's gotten warm out now. And to me, it's a great summer record, in the car with the windows down, kind of experience. So check it out. I can't believe the record's like 17 years old. It's ridiculous.
That blows my mind.
Yep. oh, wait, no, sorry. Almost 19 years old.
Ugh. Oh, boy. Well, regardless, Jesus Christ, we're old, man. I don't know when this happened, but here we are.
Yep.
So I am going to dip into a record that I had heard many years ago, and I actually bought many years ago. But, I've moved a number of times in my life, and I've thinned out my record collection at different points. I don't believe I still own this on CD. Maybe it's in a box in my shed outside or something, but I don't know where it is. It is by a band that is from Washington, D.C. It is called Shudder to Think. They are a post-punk alternative rock. I don't know how you want to categorize them, but they made a couple of records for Discord, the legendary Ian MacKaye run punk label out of DC. But this is their major label debut. They signed with Epic Records, and this also saw a lineup shift in the recording process. Before the recording process started, they added two new members, guitarist Nathan Larson and drummer Adam Wade, who Wade used to be in Jawbox, just for anyone who knows other Discord bands that eventually signed to major labels and are also awesome. But the main force behind Shudder to Think is a guy named Craig Wedren, who grew up with David Wayne of The State and Stella and Wet Hot American Summer. And so he has done the soundtrack work to anything David Wayne has ever done. So like, if you've ever seen Wet Hot American Summer, there's that great fake 80s song called Higher and Higher. That's Craig Wedren. Just an incredible songwriter, and brought something so unusual to the sort of punk alternative scene, which is before anybody else was influenced by things like glam rock, he was a very glammy guy. He would wear eyeliner. His vocal style was very like Mark Bolan in times, but he also brought this incredible funky sense of rhythm. And so you listen, when you listen to a Shudder to Think record, especially this record, Pony Express record, there are songs that start off sounding very straightforward, very like, you know, traditional rock stuff. And then the timing, something happens, whether it's a break, the band pauses, or you recognize an extra beat in a measure, or you're like, that riff is syncopated and strange. Like, he just brings this really varied sense of rhythm. There was a single from this record called Ex-French T-Shirt that became like MTV played it a fair amount. I want to say it was maybe on Beavis and Butthead. Who knows? I seem to remember that, but I could be totally wrong. But the track is incredible. That song, if you listen to that song and it speaks to you, then this record needs to be in your life. But just like I said, just really interesting, unusual songwriting. You know, I think that the term alternative, like every musical term ever, got bastardized. But to me, what alternative always meant was that it was like something you've heard before, but different enough to sort of make you sit up and say, oh, that's unusual, that's different. And to me, like, this band is the perfect encapsulation of that. On a personal note, I went to an event in 2007 that was hosted by David Wayne, Michael Showalter, Michael Ian Black, again, alums of the MTV series, The State, who were performing under the name Stella. And it was a fundraiser for the Obama campaign. And it was going to be a night of comedy and music. And Shudder to Think reunited for the first time in like 10 years at that event. And it was amazing watching the people in the room who knew what was happening, like, freak out over this. Because the Shudder to Think was never a huge band. They made two records on Epic, but they were not like world beaters by any stretch. They're this underground band. And like, I went with four or five people, and I was the only one in my group of friends who was like freaking out over this, because it was a Shudder to Think reunion, and they played Ex-Friends T-Shirt. They started with that. And like, everyone in the room who knew the song just like lost their minds at that moment. And they probably, I can't find the set list anywhere. I'm sure it's someplace on the internet. I can't find it. They probably played five or six songs, but it was amazing. And I just think that there are bands that are interesting and weird that drop off people's radars, not because of any reason, not because of any malice or any, conceivable reason. It just happens, right? And these bands can be forgotten sometimes. And when I get to remember a band like this, it makes me so happy, because I just love the fact that there were people out there making music this weird, this interesting on major labels in the mid 90s. And so I can't recommend this record highly enough. Pony Express record by Shudder to Think from 1994. Check it out. And thank you all for checking this show out. We appreciate it. Go to homerunapplesauce.com or patreon.com/homerunapplesauce to support this podcast directly. Chris is on Twitter at Chris McShane. I am on Twitter at Brian Aitzenab. And until next time, let's go Mets.